It was varied every day. Sometimes I'd be traveling to some place in Alaska, meeting with a potential new client or talking to people about a client.
A look at Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Begich's consulting career. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 30th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, after a climate change lawsuit is put in limbo by the Supreme Court, Alaskans rally.
It's a moral and spiritual issue.
And Yes.
And we are making it a legal issue as well.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The candidates are heading into the home stretch in the race to be Alaska's next governor. And you've probably heard a lot about Democratic candidate Mark Begich's career as a U.S. senator and Anchorage mayor. Begich talks less often about what he's been doing for the past 4 years. Since losing his re-election bid in 2014, he's run a consulting company that's been hired by unions, tribal groups, and businesses. Begich's work has allowed him to stay active in the same worlds of public policy and politics that he lived in as a senator and mayor. But as Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk reports, it also could present conflicts if Begich is elected governor.
Lloyd Miller is an attorney and lobbyist for Alaska Native and American Indian tribes. Some of his work is pushing Congress to pass bills, which, as everybody knows, is not exactly an easy thing to do. One thing that could make Miller's job a lot easier, he works with former U.S. Senator Mark Begich. And if he asked Begich to call up some of his former colleagues in the Senate to urge them to vote for the bills Miller wants passed,
he'd say, absolutely not. I can't do that, and I'm not going to do that. He couldn't do it for 2 years, and then he wouldn't do it since then because he did not want to be involved in lobbying.
Yeah, tough break for Miller. Federal law bars ex-senators from lobbying their old colleagues for 2 years. And, like Miller says, after that window ended, Begich decided not to register as a lobbyist, even though it probably would have been lucrative for him. One thing that Begich can and did do, however, is give other people advice about how to lobby U.S. senators. And Miller's firm paid Begich's company at least $20,000 last year for that kind of work, according to Miller and Begich's financial disclosure. Here's how Miller described it in the case of a hypothetical Senator Smith.
What he would do is he would tell me, to me, what Senator Smith is most interested in are issues A, B, and C. Defense, health care, those are his two issues. Well, if you can find a way to somehow make your issue an issue that makes sense within his frame of reference, defense or health care, you'll probably have a better shot at convincing him. But that's up to you. You've got to pull together your arguments, and then you've got to meet with his staff, and then try to get a meeting with Senator Smith. I can't do any of that for you.
In total, Begich's company had 17 paying clients last year, generating at least $885,000 in income for the firm, according to his financial disclosure. Its largest individual source of revenue was a Washington, D.C. law and lobbying firm called Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck. Brownstein has dozens of accounts, from Walgreens to Amazon to MGM Resorts. Neither Begich nor Brownstein will say which clients he worked with. What business Begich's firm, called Northern Compass Group, did for clients in Alaska is more clear. Northern Compass researched Alaska renters insurance law for Widener apartment homes, which has more than 5,000 units in the state, a Widener spokesman says. The firm worked for Chugach Electric Association on the Anchorage Co-op's proposed merger with a municipal utility, and it advised Planned Parenthood in its fights with Congress and the Trump administration, a spokesman says. Begich wouldn't agree to talk about the details of his consulting work, but here's how he described it generally in an interview with Alaska Public Media.
It was varied every day. Sometimes I'd be traveling to some place in Alaska, meeting with a potential new client or talking to people about a client, or we'd be just, you know, the team would be doing other projects related. So very eclectic.
If Begich is elected governor, he's almost certain to face decisions that will affect the companies, unions, and organizations that have been paying him. This year, for example, the governor had to decide to sign or veto a bill to protect Alaska Native corporations from having to pay to clean up land that was contaminated when they received it from the federal government. One of Begich's clients is Sitnasauk Native Corporation, and it was pushing for the bill's passage, according to a report it later filed with state regulators. Asked how Begich would handle situations like that if he's elected, his campaign manager says his office and the entire administration would be, quote, held to the highest ethical standards, following all laws and state regulations. She says details of Northern Compass Group's continued operations and Begich's ownership stake would be worked out after the election. Anchorage Independent Representative Jason Gren, who pushed ethics reforms in the legislature for the past 2 years, says that if he's elected, Begich needs to be transparent and accountable about his relationships with his former clients.
You know, I don't think anyone should be disqualified at all, but just because they've been successful in the past. But the recentness and the vastness, I just think, you know, he should understand that people are going to be maybe perhaps more critical than governors in the past, you know, who had a law firm or had other business dealings. And he should be sensitive to that and take the steps needed to show these aren't going to inject themselves into his best vision for Alaska.
Begich's opponents have also questioned his loyalty to Alaskans' interests by describing his work for the past 4 years as lobbying. But that label isn't accurate. Lobbying has a specific definition under federal law. After his 2-year cooling off period, if Begich wanted to directly influence members of Congress on legislation, he would have had to formally register as a lobbyist. He hasn't done that. What he can do is give advice to other people who are lobbying and trying to influence Congress. That's become a pretty common thing for former government officials, and good government groups are critical of the practice. They say it's a way for ex-lawmakers to monetize the experience they developed during their careers in public service. But Miller, the tribal lawyer and lobbyist, says there's a big distinction between what Begich can do and what a registered lobbyist does. He says it's very different to advise lobbyists on how they should approach members of Congress versus picking up the phone and making those calls yourself.
I mean, it's not a line, it's a river, because there's such an enormous gap. I would have loved, he's such a great advocate, I would have loved for him to actually become a registered lobbyist, because he would be great at it. He would be super at it.
And he would probably, you would probably pay him a lot more if he could do that, correct?
Well, unfortunately, I couldn't afford him. People like him who become registered lobbyists seriously earn $1 million, $2 million more a year in Washington, D.C.
Begich's campaign manager says he isn't interested in lobbying and never has been. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
Cuts to the state budget and permanent fund dividend dominated a debate Monday between Republican Senate President Pete Kelly and Democratic Representative Scott Kawasaki. The incumbent and challenger also clashed over state Medicaid and climate change in their last debate, before voters next Tuesday decide the outcome of the Interior's most heated legislative race. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Kelly told about 40 people at the forum on the UAF campus that he supported cutting the university system's operating budget by some 10% in 2015 because state revenues had dropped sharply due to the plummeting price of oil.
Our revenue was cut by a tremendous amount. We had oil that funds our budget at about $110 per barrel, and it went down to $26 per barrel.
Kelly says he was able to help UAF by convincing lawmakers to go along with appropriating $245 million to build a new coal-fired power plant for the campus. But he returned several times to his refrain about falling oil prices forcing budget cuts when Kawasaki criticized him for refusing to consider any alternative that included raising revenues.
We should have every option on the table when it comes to figuring out how we pay for education and how we pay for troopers and how we pay for the university. The income tax that I supported during that time was one that I supported because it was part of a comprehensive fiscal plan.
Kawasaki says the plan included a combination of budget cuts and taxes proposed by Governor Bill Walker and supported by the bipartisan House leadership. He says the cuts demanded by Kelly and other Republicans deepened the recession that has left Alaska with the nation's poorest performing economy.
We're 50th in employment rate. We're also 50th in job growth. We're number 40 in job growth for the private sector.
Kawasaki likened his support for additional revenue sources to Kelly's comment about making tough decisions to continue cutting the budget.
Sometimes it will take a legislator that says, you know what, we do need more money for this particular thing.
But Kelly attacked Kawasaki for supporting Walker's reduction of Alaskans' PFDs to $1,600, which the governor proposed after Senate Republicans refused to go along with other proposed revenue sources. And Kelly says hiking taxes while the economy was tanking only would have aggravated the job losses.
When you have 12,000 people being laid off, what you don't want to do is start putting an income tax on the people that have a job. So we fought against the income tax.
Kelly says revenues have picked up in recent weeks as oil prices have risen, and he says some university funding has been restored. On another issue, Kelly said in response to a student moderator's question that the state's Medicaid system is broken. He says reforms included in a measure he introduced and helped pass in 2015 fixes some of those problems and has saved the state some $400 million.
The crux of my bill, the portion of my bill, was eligibility verification, making sure people didn't use boutique drugs when they could take generic drugs, travel restrictions, emergency room restrictions.
Kelly didn't respond to a question about whether he supports Medicaid expansion in Alaska. In answer to a question on how the state should respond to climate change, Kelly says the state should try to help people in littoral communities where erosion is chewing away the coastline, but he cautioned against involving the state too deeply in the issue.
What I am nervous about when I hear about climate change, it's that we will adopt kind of the larger political agenda that is extremely expensive, and it's very difficult to navigate through the United Nations treaties and some of the regulations that come out of places like the EPA, et cetera.
Kawasaki pounced on that response, accusing Kelly of denying climate change, which he says affects all Alaskans. And he says it's an issue UAF researchers have been studying for decades.
Alaskans and this university can be front and center in research to try to figure out how we mitigate the problems.
Kawasaki says despite dire warnings and predictions, he's hopeful that an immediate and concerted response could slow or reverse global warming. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, unlike in Anchorage and Fairbanks, the University of Alaska Southeast is seeing an increase in enrollment.
Our first-time students, including our freshman students, but also others coming back for the very first time, are up by 10%.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you need health insurance for 2019? Alaska's individual market health insurance rates have dropped by more than 28% in the last 2 years. Most Alaskans who sign up at healthcare.gov are eligible for tax credits to help pay the costs. Open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th this year. Check out healthcare.gov to find out what your insurance options are for 2019. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Officials say a man wanted by police in Utqiagvik fatally shot one person and injured two others after they kicked him out of a home during a party to celebrate his 27th birthday. Asiagan Dana Amawik is charged in a criminal complaint with second-degree murder and two counts of assault in the shooting. It was Sunday morning in Utqiagvik. The criminal complaint says Amawik knocked on the door of the home after he was kicked out. It says when the door was opened, he shot three people and left. One died at the scene. North Slope Borough Police and other officials have released few other details of the shooting. Borough Police announced a $5,000 reward for information leading to Amawik's arrest. Well, yesterday was supposed to mark the start of a trial in a landmark climate change lawsuit brought against the U.S. federal government by almost two dozen young Americans. The lawsuit, Juliana versus United States, argues that the government has violated the constitutional rights of 21 youth plaintiffs by actively worsening climate change with its policies. But the case has been placed temporarily in limbo by the Supreme Court. So instead of a trial, the day was marked by rallies in support of the case. One of those rallies took place in Fairbanks. Over 50 people showed up to hear speeches from mostly youth speakers. Tom Baring, the father of one of the plaintiffs, 19-year-old Nathan Baring, also spoke.
This is no longer a scientific issue. It's not a scientific question. It's a moral and spiritual issue.
And
yes.
And we are making it a legal issue as well.
Rallies were also held in Anchorage and Sitka, and a youth engagement event in support of the lawsuit was held in Homer. According to a press release from Our Children's Trust, the legal organization supporting the plaintiffs, there were 70-some events planned across the U.S. for Sunday and Monday. Climate change, as well as rural aviation, are major issues in the YK Delta. And Senator Lisa Murkowski addressed both during her visit to the region last week. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger reports in Bethel.
Murkowski visited Quinnahock as part of her trip. It's one of 56 villages in the region and sits on the coast near the Kuskokwim Bay. Like many YK Delta communities, it's experiencing erosion from rising sea levels and melting permafrost, and is struggling to maintain its gravel airstrip.
Had an opportunity to look at the impacts of erosion and some of the issues that they're dealing with, whether it is their airport, whether it is their sewer lagoon, but just the impacts to infrastructure that will be necessary to review.
The Yupik community is also the site of a massive archaeological dig. Quinnahock is trying to save its heritage, thousands of artifacts from the bow and arrow wars of the 1600s, from washing into the sea. Murkowski says she's focused on tackling rural aviation and climate change. For rural aviation, she says Congress just passed legislation that would prioritize airport construction in, quote, cold weather locations.
We just don't have enough time during the summer season, and the airports are being used all day in, day out.
The legislation makes sure safety equipment arrives more quickly at rural airports and allows Alaska cargo planes to deliver fully charged lithium-ion batteries.
These are often used in things like pacemakers. Well, if you can't get these fully charged batteries out to the region on an airplane, how do folks get the necessary medical equipment? So that's a very specific Alaska exemption.
And maintaining a rural airstrip also means battling melting permafrost, which can cause dips in the runway. And of course, some villages in the YK Delta, like Quinnahock and Newtok, face another big infrastructure problem, erosion. And that's expensive to fix. I asked Murkowski if Congress plans to define climate change as an emergency under the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. That would make it easier for communities like Newtok and Quinnahock, who are facing relocation and major infrastructure problems because of erosion linked to climate change, to get federal funding. Murkowski doesn't think that's a good idea.
And when you think about climate change and the impacts that we are seeing, it's not a hurricane that has come up within a few days. These are slow-moving disasters, but our reality is, in my view, that FEMA is not necessarily the best entity for addressing the potential disaster that you can see coming.
She says FEMA is an agency focused on responding to disasters, not trying to prevent or mitigate it. She thinks it makes more sense for an agency like the Army Corps of Engineers, for instance, to take preventative measures to contend with climate change. I asked her if she thought that was possible with the current administration. The Trump administration is trying to roll back major environmental regulations that would cut down on greenhouse gas emissions.
If what we're talking about is a wholesale kind of overhaul of a department that would allow for prevention, adaptation, mitigation strategy from the agency focused specific to climate change, in the 2 years of the Trump administration, I don't see that happening.
But she says the solution could happen with a little different phrasing.
If you're an administration that says, well, we want to be smart with the taxpayer dollars, you work on infrastructure and technologies that will, for instance, be more enduring when you're looking at how you build out an airstrip. For many in this current administration, it's how we talk about getting to the same goal, which I think is important.
And Murkowski says that there are plans underway in agencies to help build more, quote, resilient infrastructure that will withstand the impacts of climate change, from more hurricanes to rising sea levels to melting permafrost. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Enrollment has declined across the University of Alaska system for the last few years. But at the Southeast campus, enrollment is actually up for the first-year students. There are also more students enrolled in career and technical programs. And as KTOO's Adeline Baxter explains, that may have something to do with increased outreach and a tuition discount for certain courses.
It's a Wednesday evening in the Glacier Room at the University of Alaska Southeast. Outreach coordinator Sue Reyes is hosting an off-to-college event for prospective students. Turnout isn't great, but she's not discouraged.
Three or four, some with parents, some by themselves, and, you know, maybe just a parent come in.
She visits the local high schools every week, and she and her colleagues also attend college conferences around Alaska and the Northwest.
That's really been like an initiative for us, is just to do a little bit more recruiting events and getting with our community to just let them know that UAS is here and we're here to help.
Overall, enrollment at UAS is down more than 3% from last year. That's not bad considering it's the smallest campus in the UA system. At Anchorage and Fairbanks, enrollment has declined even more. UAS Chancellor Rick Caulfield presented more numbers for this school year at a Juneau Chamber of Commerce luncheon last week.
Our first-time students, including our freshman students, but also others coming back for the very first time, are up by 10%.
One of the things Caulfield highlighted was the fact that enrollment in career and technical programs went up 19% for UAS this year. That's classes like nurse aid training, heavy machinery and diesel mechanics for mining, and marine transportation. Caulfield said the increase is thanks in part to stepped-up recruitment and a 25% tuition decrease for some classes that the UA Board of Regents approved last year. It took effect for the first time this fall.
Of course, we're going to look closely to make sure that it's accomplishing what we want it to do, which was to encourage more young people to look at career and technical education career opportunities here in Southeast Alaska.
The discount reduces tuition for a $200 per credit class to $150 per credit. It applies on a course-by-course basis to about 50 programs and more than 300 classes across the university system. Overall, the number of people enrolled in these courses at UAS is still small, less than 70 students. Caulfield says he hopes to see that number grow over time, especially as they work to increase the pipeline between high school and campus.
The more we can build a relationship with the high schools, so that even high school students can earn college credits and have the benefit of that 25% tuition reduction while they're still in high school and they're already on a pathway into a college program before they graduate high school.
Caulfield said they have a budget request to hire an additional recruiter for next year. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
Many snow-starved parts of Alaska have seen the ground finally turn to white. But as for this notion of a white Halloween, it's like anticipation building in the lower 48 for a white Christmas. Let's just go with it. Some places in Alaska may not reach that benchmark, technically speaking. That's because, as UAF climatologist Brian Brettschneider tells me, technically there would need to be enough to round up to 1 inch. Brettschneider says, at least at the official technical lower-lying measuring sites in Anchorage and Fairbanks, it's looking like Halloween will not have a total of more than half an inch, technically, and therefore an unwhite, technically, Halloween.
That's a little bit misleading because pretty much everyone has snow on the ground, but it's the third year in a row for Fairbanks with less than an inch of snow on the ground. So even though they have an over 90% track record of having an inch plus of snow on the ground on Halloween, this is the third year in a row that they're going to not live up to that expectation.
Tell me more about the snowfall around the state. I guess Anchorage got its first real snow, Fairbanks, Bethel, since the last time we talked elsewhere. How would you characterize this year's kind of first real snowfall for a lot of the state?
We are way behind for snow almost everywhere. I mean, Fairbanks had their least snowiest October on record. Anchorage has had some Octobers with no snow before. Bethel had their first snow of the season yesterday. That's the second latest they've ever gone for their first snow, and their first latest was back in 1937. And then Nome and Kotzebue, they've started to get a little bit of snow, but they're way behind. King Salmon has had no snow. So most places way behind on snow. And that's actually a trend for the last 15 or so years. October used to be much snowier, especially in the interior. October used to be the snowiest month of the year. That has drastically changed with much reduced snowfall in the month of October.
And colder, if I remember correctly. There was a Halloween in my past when I was younger where it was very cold and I refused to wear a warm coat because it would ruin my costume. And I got pneumonia that winter, unfortunately. But I wonder if you could take us back to some bygone years where it was a little colder and what sort of records are we looking at?
So some of the Halloweens in the early 1970s, very, very cold. So 1975 is kind of the benchmark. There were some places in the interior that dropped below zero, like in North Pole, for example, was 41 below zero. And even for the high temperature, so Fairbanks that year had a high of minus 20. And then if you go back to, say, the early 1990s, 1992 in particular, very, very cold. Temperatures in the minus 20s, minus 30s around the central interior, high temperatures below zero, quite a bit colder.
So am I allowed to say, like, you know, back in my day, it was colder and snowier. We had to walk uphill both ways. Do I have a legit right to that?
In this case, yes. You know, my experience is people's weather memories are very often quite flawed. People say, oh, it was colder then or it was warmer then. And I pull up the record books. And in many cases, again, people's memories are really sketchy. In this case, those weather memories are probably correct. You know, we've been talking about a white Halloween, but a couple places have had really wet Halloweens in the past. Places like Cordova, Kodiak, some areas in the Juneau area, 6, 7, even as much as 9 inches of rain on Halloween's past. The record is 1935, 9.5 inches of rain at the Perseverance Mine near Juneau. But even in recent years, like Little Port Walter on Baranoff Island, 8.5 inches of rain in 2003, and 5.5 inches of rain just 4 years ago. So those areas in Southeast, this is the heart of their rainy season. So, you know, those big Gulf of Alaska storms can dump a lot of rain on Halloween.
So if you're a kid down there trying to go out trick-or-treating, you should be dressed as like Aquaman or the Little Mermaid or something, I guess.
Definitely. You know, in the mainland part of the state, dressing up for Halloween conundrum is always wearing a big parka or jacket over your Halloween outfit. In Southeast, it's going to be wearing a rain jacket.
Yes, the parka lesson I learned the hard way. Brian, thanks as always for being here.
My pleasure.
Brian Brett Schneider is a climatologist based in Anchorage with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He checks in every other week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. And finally tonight, a correction to a story we ran yesterday about the Kanakanak Hospital survey in Dillingham. It said misprescribed medication caused a patient to go into shock, but in fact, the medication had been incorrectly filled. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Nat Herz in Anchorage, Tim Ellis and Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks, Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, and Adeline Baxter in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Ammon Swenson. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The general election is November the 6th. Polls are open 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. You will be voting for United States Representative, Governor, Lieutenant Governor, State Senator, State Representative, judges, and one ballot measure. When you vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have an ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring somebody to assist you. To find your polling place, visit elections.alaska.gov. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.